Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's just after high noon, and thanks so much for joining us on Nation Radio. A very busy afternoon. A hockey game, actually several hockey games to look after this afternoon. We'll give you updates on that. And, of course, it's hockey day in Canada, plus trade deadline talk. It's a busy one. Our guest today will be Kent Wilson from Flames Nation, Jonathan Willis from Oilers Nation, Cult of Hockey, Copper and Blue, and others. Jason Greger from Jason Greger Show. We'll talk to him. He did a great Bobby Holik interview. I want to ask him some questions about that earlier in the week. I think it was Thursday. They had a great discussion. And we'll talk about deadline as well with Jason. And Cam Giron from Canucks Army will join us before 2 o'clock today. As I mentioned, it is Hockey Day in Canada, a celebration of the game at all levels and for all ages. And we're going to talk about that in depth today. And I invite you to email me at nationradio@team1260.com, or you can also check me on Twitter at lowtide_ as well. It was maybe 1969. When I discovered that skating backwards was impossible and skating forward was not much better for me personally. But, you know, my love for the game has increased since then, and I think it gets stronger every day. It's a beautiful thing. It brings you together. It gives you a sense of belonging, of culture. Obviously, we live in the North, and, you know, there's a million things to do, but hockey's more fun than, I would say, two of them, which I will not name now, but I think you can probably figure it out. So, on the Oilers Nation blog today, I talked about some of my earliest and strongest memories, mostly involving the Oilers, the Gretzky shot over the shoulder of Mike Vernon, Glenn Anderson racing down the ice, the Grant Fuhr shutout, the 1-0 shutout that a lot of people believe was maybe the most important game in franchise history. That was the same day that Kevin McClellan scored that goal, 1-0. They beat the Islanders, and then I think they probably felt like, hey, we can win, and they finally did a little... Well, maybe a week or so later. That was in 1984. So lots of fond memories about the Oilers. Now, I'm an old guy. Connor, who's our producer, and a great producer he is. What do you have on Twitter now? 14,000?
I was up to 88. I dropped to 86.
I notice everybody, like, Majot's giving you a push.
Yeah, we were trying to, you know, bribe people to follow me, and it worked for a night. And then once I was not giving away free things, they leave me.
You're a clever guy, too.
I don't
too.
Want my wit and insight on things,
you
I guess.
You are a clever guy. You really are. Okay, you're like 20. I'm 2.5 times older than you. What are your fondest Hockey Day in Canada memories?
Hockey Day in Canada last year. I was at the game.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's... Other than that, it's just hockey memories.
Okay, well, that's what I'm saying.
The Todd Marchand goal, obviously.
Yeah.
The cup run a few years ago.
06, yeah.
Other than that, you know, beating Dallas was the biggest thing for me growing up after losing to them all those years.
Do you remember, like, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but you were really young, obviously, then. Do you remember how well Cujo played in that game?
I remember his glove save the play before.
Like, oh, man, he was on fire. I remember thinking to myself, we're going to win. I always do that. Whenever we win a playoff round, I get overly excited.
And that was his birthday.
Yeah.
That was on his birthday, I remember.
Crazy. Well, that was I'd forgotten about that, and that was a very cool memory, too. So, the Oilers are on the ice today against Ottawa, and we will definitely give you updates on that. Ryan Smith, we know, wasn't wearing the bucket during warm-up. That's courtesy Joanne Ireland, so lots happening there today. Have you done the who's hot, who's not on TSN for the Oilers? Have you run that? This is the game day sheet from Edmonton at Ottawa, and the who's hot section has this. Sam Gagne, 14 points in the last four games. Jordan Eberle, 8 points in the last four games. Taylor Hall, 9 points in the last six games. Hey, not bad. So that line will be together. No real changes in the roster today except Nikolai Habibulin is in, and obviously Dubnyk stays out. And on the blue line, Cam Barker sits. He's been struggling. And Andy Sutton draws back in. I think there may be some showcasing going on. I don't know about Habibulin because he's got that extra year. And we hear rumors. Jason Greger had an item on Oilers Nation today talking about Sutton wanting to stay here, you know, maybe negotiating another deal. That could happen too, but there's also the possibility that Sutton is being showcased. We hear Chicago as a team that might be looking at maybe picking up a defenseman somewhere along the way. And maybe they also need goaltending, so maybe it could be a package deal. Oilers might have to bring back some money because of Habby's extra year at, I think, 3.75, but that's off the top of my head. But the Gagne week was something spectacular. We missed last week. I couldn't do the show last week for personal reason, but I'll tell you what. This last, say, five games for Gagne, 15 points. And one of the subjects we're going to talk about today, aside from hockey days in Canada and the trade deadline, is Gagne a guy who maybe is turning a corner? You know, he's not an old player. He was drafted in 07, but he didn't turn 20 until 09. So he's like 22 years old on the way to being 23 in August. And sometimes it takes a player a couple of years to find his way. Obviously, he's playing with outstanding wingers right now. But we'll talk about that today. Maybe Sam Gagner is at a point in his career where things are going to turn around for him. And, you know, he's not going to be that 40-point guy that everybody's kind of disappointed in. Maybe he's going to be something more than that. And even if he does score 45 to 50 points on a two-line, that's really good production for today's National Hockey League. So we'll talk about that. Taylor Hall on track for 30 goals. Jordan Eberle leading the team in pretty much everything. How good are they? Well, we're going to find out, I think, because based on time on ice, Tom Rennie has kind of been nursing them through a little bit and giving those veterans like Horkoff and Smith and Hemsky and Jones more zone starts or more difficult zone starts, more time on ice, more penalty killing, what we would call the scut work or the heavy lifting. And that may change almost immediately because Aleš Hemsky is a guy who may end up being traded here at the deadline. And then your right winger has become Eberle, Jones, maybe Pajarvi if you move him over on the right side. So that veteran depth that you had is all of a sudden gone, and you can use Petrell over there. But still, a guy like Jordan Eberle is likely to play more power play minutes and also more minutes on the at even strength as well. It's a situation now where I think we're going to see a different kind of Oiler team and more difficult minutes for the kids, and it'll be interesting to see how they react on that. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins kind of getting left behind right now because of his injury. And if you're an Oiler fan, and I definitely am an Oiler fan, I've been waiting for them to win. They've won everything else in my lifetime as a fan. They won, you know, 5 Stanleys, Hart trophies, all of this stuff, but they've never won a Calder trophy. And Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, I'm telling you, until he got hurt, it was, you know, he was secretariat in the race for the Calder Trophy. It was gone. Now he gets hurt, and this Adam Henrique kid is playing really well. He's got some good wingers, but so did Nugent Hopkins. And he's a guy who I think maybe might end up winning the Calder if Nugent Hopkins can't come back. So something to think about, and we'll talk about all those stories and more on Hockey Day in Canada and trade deadline, of course, at the top of the heap. Of course, the Oilers are playing right away. And with that in mind, I thought we'd check in a little bit with Tom Rennie, find out a little bit about what he thinks about the game before the game starts.
Well, he's got a good presence, of course. He's got leadership in him. His size and reach and strength and those types of things are certainly something that we need. When he's on his game, we seem to be a little bit more poised on our own end, a little more confident doing things. He needs to come in, certainly when he does, and provide that for us.
Can he also make life a little miserable for skilled players with some of the physicality he brings? I mean, he's a guy that, if I'm a skill guy, I don't really want to play against him.
Yeah, no, he needs that. And you hope that it's contagious and others provide the same thing. It can't be incumbent on one person to do that. And we have others capable of it. But certainly that's very much a part of his DNA, and we need it.
What about the last couple of practice days coming off the performance against Detroit? Do you feel better about your hockey club going into tomorrow?
You know, I do. I've always liked the way we practice for the most part, save a couple. But, I thought it was important to purge the Detroit game with a good practice yesterday. I like what we did. The guys worked hard. They felt spent. That's important. I thought today as a shorter practice and getting ready for tomorrow, that's almost like our morning skate, if you will, game day skate. There was good energy there, good synergy amongst them. That's all good things. We have played pretty good here in the last while, and we want to get back to doing things right. And really, that starts in practice.
Looks like you've made a couple of adjustments to your power play units. Do those units sometimes just need freshened up from time to time to keep them sharp?
Yes, they do, and it also depends on who's available to us, and what types of shots we like to set up. But there's nothing wrong with that. You can become a little bit too predictable, at times, too, if you're not careful with your power play, and you want to make sure that, you can make the odd adjustment to keep the other team off balance, and we hope we've done that.
It appears that Gagner might be joining Eberle and Hall. Does that maybe make it easier for you as the road coach to kind of keep that line cohesive because they're maybe sharing the same power play unit as well?
It certainly makes it easier. I mean, not that as a coach you're looking for the easy way, but it makes sense, too. I mean, they're playing well as a trio. To put them on the ice as a power play unit makes sense as well with the extra attacker and the extra room, and they're doing a good job 5-on-5, so it stands to reason you'd want to give that a try on a power play.
Tom, does it seem, while on Gagner, every time he's on the ice now that a point's going to happen?
I'm hoping so. So far, so good. Yeah, I mean, he's been real good, and I think we need to take the opportunity to talk about Sam's perseverance, and his determination to plow through a season that, at times, as it has for everyone, has been tough, and he's maintained the course and been very professional about it, and he's getting the just reward as many can when they decide to stick with it.
You've been around hockey for a few years. What was that 8-point night like? What did that feel like for you personally?
Well, it was great. I've been in the other team's bench when other guys have gotten magnificent 600th goals and those types of things, and it's not been fun. So to see one of your own players do something special like that is special, and especially, within our franchise, quite honestly, where we've had arguably the best hockey player to play, a part of our organization at one time, and Sam being able to kind of rub shoulders with that is pretty special for him and certainly all of us. And we're looking for good things. We're looking to grow and develop. And as I mentioned to the crew the other day, we're still sort of in the petri dish, so things like this suggest that we're starting to grow and flourish.
The matchup tomorrow specifically against the Senators, when you take a look at their personnel, what are some critical components that you see factoring heavily into tomorrow's game?
Well, I think the first thing we want to do is make sure they don't find their game like they did last night against Nashville. We have to take our game to them. We have to get pucks in behind them and just simply outwork this team, with first and foremost, I think. Beyond that, they've got some guys with some skill that can move a puck, make plays, and make life real miserable for you if you allow them to sort of dance around you. So we've got to make sure that we're physical, that we're in the face of these guys whenever we can be. And I think that it could come down to a specialty team's afternoon. They're funny games to play. Sometimes you're on it and sometimes you're not. And with that being said, you can either have your power play on the ice or your penalty kill on the ice, and you have that choice depending on how hard you want to work.
You come back with me.
I'm planning on that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you
let him? I did. I thought he battled hard in Detroit. I thought that to an extent, at least we kind of let him down a little bit. I'm not sure I could draw a real conclusion as to how good or how bad he was based on his team's performance in front of him. But I saw a goaltender that battled hard, and I want to give him another crack tomorrow.
Can you talk about Jeff Petry? This is a guy when everyone was healthy at the beginning of the year, who sent down the players. Now everybody's healthy again. There's no way he's coming out of the line.
I don't see him coming out of the lineup. I do have 8 defensemen. I'll pull somebody out if they're not performing well, and it's nice to have that leverage, and they all know that. And that being said, he's going to have to trip up big time here to remove himself from the lineup, but I'll be quick to do it if I have to. Yeah, that's how a young guy learns. I mean, it's just hand over opportunity. You have to continue to earn that, and now that we have some numbers to work with, I can certainly exercise that option. But, Jeff has continued to play well, and the things that come obvious are his skating ability, his passing ability, his ability to shoot, but he's got a real good gap. He's confident in his gap game. He's confident with his body and how he plays a more physical game now, given what he is. So, as I mentioned yesterday, this is arrow up, for us on a defenseman. When I first saw him, I thought that, he had the makings of a good NHL defenseman. I wasn't sure as to when he'd be able to nail it.
That's Tom Rennie talking a little bit about the game. They're doing they're honoring Chris Phillips right now at Ottawa, so the game has not started yet. But talking a little bit about, two young guys who are really having an impact on the team right now. Jeff Petry, who I think Oiler fans are really hoping turns into a legit top four defenseman. And man, he is really looking good lately. And then Sam Gagner, who, since 07-08, when he was a rookie and scored 49 points, I think most people feel like, at least in terms of points, he's been a little disappointing. But if you look at the underlying numbers, he's slow improvement. He's playing a little bit tougher competition. Things like Corsi Rel and secondary indicators are that, he's progressing. And that's what you can hope for a young guy. I think, hindsight tells us that, he probably should have gone back to junior, spent a couple of years there, and then come out at 20 as did Eberle. But having said that, maybe he's turned a corner. And our first guest today, Jonathan Willis, will address that because we're going to ask him a question. Jonathan, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing really well, Alan. How are you today?
I'm good. I was talking a little bit about Sam Gagner and the fact that sometimes these players, especially centers, because it's such a difficult position, take a little time to mature and play at a level that, maybe meets the expectations. Do you think that the last, say, 5 games or so is an indicator of Gagner's turning the corner, or is it a flash in the pan, or is it something in between?
I'm going to go with something in between there because I like wishy-washy middle-of-the-fence answers.
Me too.
obviously, it's a really Gagne's been phenomenal during this little stretch that he's on right now. But the way I think about it is, if this had happened 2 months ago, if we could put this stretch of five games in mid-February and bump all his other games forward, this wouldn't even be a question. We'd be talking about Sam Gagne as that guy who scored 8 points that game and is on pace for pretty much his normal offensive output this season. So I don't want to read too much into this short stretch of brilliance. I've always been a fan of Gagne. I think he's a player, but this doesn't drastically change where I project him to be long-term.
Do you think that at this point, though, with this hot streak, he was rumored, in fact, Darren Dreger at TSN was the one who said that when Steve Tambellini would call other teams and ask for a top four defenseman, often the first name mentioned was Gagne, because they know that the top three kids are off the table. Do you think this hot streak probably gives the Oilers a little bit of hesitance to even include him in conversation?
Yeah, I think it does. I don't know if it necessarily should. I think whatever their opinion of Gagne was before this stretch, it shouldn't have drastically changed based on this stretch. But it wouldn't surprise me if it's making them hesitate a little more before dealing him. And I have no doubt that it increases his value in any trade talks.
Speaking of trade talks, we'll get back. I have another secondary Gagne question to ask you in a minute. But it appears to be a slow trade market based on what we heard. Mark Spector was on the station yesterday talking to, he mentioned a couple of scouts he talked to, and specifically regard to Hemsky, and said it was a soft trade market. In regard to Hemsky, do you think, based on what we read and what we know, that there's an appetite to possibly re-sign him even to a one-year deal if the market isn't right, or do you think the Oilers would prefer to send him off for lesser payback at the trade deadline?
Oh, I have very little doubt they're going to deal him. Just reading between the lines, it's got to be a lot of people I trust and respect are saying he's almost certainly gone. I think he's gone. I don't think they're going to keep him. I think they'll trade him for whatever they can get. I'm very curious to see what kind of return they'll get for him in a trade, because when you look at the top forwards out there, if a team's looking for a top six forward on a rental, there's not a lot of options available. Tuomo Ruutu is most frequently mentioned, but now we hear things out of Carolina that he's likely to be re-signed. And there's just not a huge market of offensive top six forwards who can do what Hemsky does that are available on a rental deal. So I think they'll get something for him.
I agree. I talked to Kent Wilson a couple of weeks ago, and we've got him coming up a little later in the show. And I asked him point blank. I said, I think he's worth a first-round pick, plus maybe a little bit. Do you think they can get a first-round pick for him? And Kent said that, you know, he didn't think there'd be any problem getting that. Do you think Oiler fans maybe are so divided on this player that it's almost impossible to get, you know, a consensus on what he might be worth?
In a lot of ways, I think he's a mirror image of Gagne. Sam Gagne, prior to this season, It was hard. It was getting awfully lonely to be in the Sam Gagne booster club this summer. People did not believe in him. He's been around for a long time. He hadn't put up big numbers. Even his early season coming off injury was not very good, but he has an 8-point night, and suddenly, you know, perception shift. Mm-hmm. Whereas Alex Hemsky has bled and been broken for this franchise for years and years and has scored at a very high level prior to this season. And he's not having a good season, I'll be the first to admit that. But the amount of vitriol generated toward him based on this year, as opposed to looking at his whole career with the Oilers, I think it's gone a little far.
I've been interested in I think when that kind of you call it vitriol, when that kind of vitriol hits one specific player who's been such a big part of the team for a long time, a cynical person might suggest that this is some kind of a script that's being written to escort him out. Ryan Smith certainly had a similar experience in what was 06-07, I guess. As far as Alex Hemsky is concerned, to me he's a ticking bomb for the Oilers, in that if they trade him for less than full value and he goes to a Western team, as an example, this is a guy who is not 35 years old. He's not an older Sutton or Habibulin. He might have 10 more years in the league to come here and kick our ass every year.
Yeah, and that's certainly a possibility. With Hemsky, of course, my fear is injuries. But his age, like the fact that Mark Crawford a while back said he was too old to be a part of the Oilers' rebuild, I think that's ridiculous. He's in the prime of his career. The question is injuries. Age-wise, if he's healthy, he's going to be a good player for could be 10 years.
You mentioned that injury is a concern. The only other argument that I've read, and I can't tweak the numbers well enough to be able to answer this question. Maybe you can shine a light. The Oilers sooner or later are going to have to talk to Hall and Eberle, maybe as soon as this summer when the clock ticks through and they can begin talking to them about their second contracts. Do you see a difficulty in getting Hemsky signed? Let's say they do it for 3 years at 15 mil. Do you think that would impact any of the kids coming up and getting contracts, or should they be able to shoehorn all of them in?
No, I don't think it'll be a problem at all. And the reason I say that is because this franchise has shown a willingness to spend money beyond what's on the cap if they think it's in their best interests. So we had Sheldon Surrey badmouth Oilers management, and they blew his $5 million-plus contract into the minors for it. So if they can get rid of a player like Surrey because of something, a personal pique, they figure they don't want him around these young players, even though they desperately need a defenseman, then I don't know why they couldn't send Sean Horkoff, for example, or any pick any contract on the team. They can dump a contract in the minors if they feel they need to get kids under contract, and there's bound to be somebody who's underperforming who they can ship out.
The thing that always surprised me about the or at least this fall surprised me about the Hemsky verbal is that the Oilers, going all the way back to Glenn Sather, always at least full valued, maybe overvalued pure skill. I mean, honestly, they'd bring in failed first round picks every year, and they always had guys who were maybe weren't delivering but had the potential to become really good offensive players. Well, Alex Hemsky is a guy who creates offense and does it brilliantly and is an interesting, entertaining player to watch. But the Oilers seem to have soured on him, and I guess it's because of the injury history. Where, if you were going to guess, and I'm putting you on the spot here, but do you think this is a player that they value, that they would like to send to the Eastern Conference as opposed to sending him to Detroit or somewhere, or does that matter?
Personally, I wouldn't imagine that it matters for them. Obviously, they have a bit of say over where he eventually ends up. If they send him to an Eastern team, there's a chance that team signs him, but he's an unrestricted free agent this summer, so you can trade him wherever you want, in my opinion, because he's probably going to test the market and probably going to go wherever he can get the most money.
Let's change gears a little bit. We're talking to Jonathan Willis, who's from Cult of Hockey, Copper and Blue, Oilers Nation, and pages of other sources throughout the week on the internet. You wrote a great article this week on Jordan Eberle's season, it being both exceptional and a little scary because it may not be repeatable. Can you talk a little bit about what he's doing well and what he's doing that he may not be able to repeat as the seasons roll forward?
Oh, sure. I think anybody who's watched the Oilers this year would agree that Jordan Eberle is one of the most easy to watch players on the team. He's one of the more exciting players. He's either the best offensive talent on the team or right up there. He's having a tremendous year. He's on pace for 64 even strength points, which is just off the charts good. That's not total points, that's even strength points. So there's a lot there to really love. The fact that he's doing it at 21 is nothing but good. On the other hand, I think a lot of things have gone right for him this year. On-ice shooting percentage is something that tends to fluctuate around even for really elite players. And right now, Eberle's, among NHL forwards, nobody has a higher on-ice shooting percentage than Jordan Eberle. Now, I'd like to use Sedin's as an analogy here. 2 years ago, they had a 14% on-ice shooting percentage, which is where Eberle is at this year. They haven't repeated it since. They've been down in the 9-10 range. And I think it's realistic to expect that that's where Eberle's on-ice shooting percentage goes. Now, to compensate for that, what they did in Vancouver was they've changed how they've used the Sedins. They've given them more and more time in the offensive zone, and so we haven't really seen their point totals dip a lot because Vigneault's been using them more and more as offensive specialists. So in Eberle's case, either he's already being used a lot in the offensive zone. I think to compensate for the inevitable dip in his on-ice shooting percentage, he either needs to develop further, which is certainly possible given his age, or be used in a more specialized role, which I don't see happening. So to make a long story short, I think there's a worry that the Oilers might sign him now to an extension or in the near future to an extension rather than waiting for next season just to see what happens. And I think that would be a mistake. I think it's good to enjoy his season while it's here, but then wait till he's playing tougher minutes, wait and see what he does next year before you sign the guy. And especially with a new CBA coming in, I think you want to wait until you see what happens there before you get these guys on long-term contracts.
A different situation, but, you know, same team and same opportunity. Do you think the Oilers should wait on Taylor Hall as well until the new CBA is set?
I'm a little less concerned about Hall because he hasn't had quite the same on-ice shooting percentage as Eberle. He's had slightly tougher sledding along the way than Eberle as well. But with the new CBA coming in, yeah, I don't think there's a rush to get this deal done. I think you can wait and see what the new conditions will be before you sign these guys.
Jonathan, I wanted to get into some Tom Rennie discussion because I think you and I both agree on him, but I'm going to have to save that for a later date. Thanks so much for this. Enjoy the game, okay?
It was a real pleasure. Thanks, Alan.
All right. That's Jonathan Willis from Cult of Hockey, Copper and Blue, Oilers Nation, and many parts as well. Interesting writer, great guy, and deserves all the accolades he gets because he's got great insight into the National Hockey League, and we're lucky as Oiler fans to have him spend so much time talking about the Oilers and what they're doing. And great points there on Jordan Eberle and perhaps having one of those perfect storm off seasons for Steve Tambellini to sign him to a contract that maybe is a bit of a reach based on some of the numbers that are coming in and some of the math that suggests that next season will be more difficult for him to deliver that kind of offense. We've got this in from Vintage Flame. Oilers fans overvalue Hemsky, much in the way Flames fans overvalued Robin Regier. Well, that's an interesting point. We'll have to wait and see how that works out. I do agree with Jonathan. I think he's gone. So we won't have to wait very long to find out what the return is on Alex Hemsky. The deadline, by the way, is February 27th. Got it covered right here on Team 1260. You'll be hearing more about that in the next week or so. This is Nation Radio, presented by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
12:33, we're around until 2 o'clock today, and then Jungle Jim Hunter joins us on Team 1260. We've got a hockey game on right now. The Oilers down 1-0 on an Alfredson goal. It's 19th from Carlson and Spezza, and the shots I have here are 7-2 right now for Ottawa. Looks like Habib Bulin's playing well, and the Oilers aren't. That's what we have so far. We'll keep you updated on that. Very busy show. We're going to talk a little bit about Hockey Day in Canada, the trade deadline, and we'll do that with Kent Wilson here in Two Shakes, and then Cam Charon later on in the show, and Jason Greger will join us as well. So, and we invite your emails as well at nationradio@team1260.com. If you've got something to share from your favorite hockey days, we'll definitely pass those along this afternoon before 2 o'clock today. Kent actually had tweeted something here 2 Shakes ago about Hemsky, which I thought was interesting. He said at low tide, looked at Hemsky's underlying numbers, 96.7 PDO, personal shooting percentage of 5.6, bad luck. And he's right. Hemsky is shooting less. And of course, he hasn't played a full number of games because of the injury, but good points all. And Kent is like that. Kent, how are you, buddy? Kent?
Yeah, good. How are you doing, Alan?
Good. Hey, listen, you've brought some great points to the table with regard to Alex Hemsky. So he's a guy who's, as you point out, probably undervalued at this point.
I think so. I mean, the thing with players like Hemsky, who has a history of, you know, double-digit shooting percentage, he also drives possession most of the time. And, you know, seasons happen like this where pucks just don't go in. And for me, if I was an NHL GM, that would represent an opportunity. Like, that's a player you bet on going forward because you can get him for cheaper just because of his counting stats, and you can bet that he's probably going to bounce back.
I think this is where zone start really starts to have an impact, too. If people view the game via zone start, we're going to talk to Cam about the Canucks center situation, which is beyond ridiculous for zone starts. But Hemsky is a guy. Obviously, they've got the kids, and they're bringing them along. But Hemsky and Horkoff and Belanger, as an example, veterans Ryan Smith as well, especially in the early part of the season, but through this part of the season, those guys are definitely doing a lot more heavy lifting, and that has an impact as well, correct?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's going to suppress their offense to some degree, just because, you know, they're playing against very good players. They're starting more often in their own end. And, you know, the high ground's going towards, I think, the kids in Edmonton, and that's giving them a chance to score a bit more.
You've been very generous talking about the Oilers, so now we're going to put you to work talking about the Flames. As much as it galls me, Pretty Boy Feaster has done a nice job down there, and the Flames are looking good for a playoff spot at this point. Do you agree or disagree with that statement?
I still think they're, 20 to 25% chance of getting in. I mean, they are close in terms of points, but they're still in a dogfight with four teams right now. So I don't know if you can bet on the Flames over anyone else they're in the mix with there, especially with all the injuries they're suffering right now. Blair Jones went down the other night. Glenn Cross is out. David Moss is out. Lee Stempniak is out. So it's getting really thin up front for the Calgary Flames.
You do have a guy who should be nicknamed Rasputin in goal, though. Is he playing the best hockey we've seen in 5 years from this guy?
I would think so. He's got a 929 save percentage at even strength right now, which is his best mark in years. We'll see if he can keep it up, because there's a couple months left in the season. But yeah, he is the reason over the last probably two months that the Flames are knocking on the door for a playoff spot.
Yeah, he reminds me of Tommy Salo when he was with the Oilers.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question here, and I'm going to put you on the spot, and I apologize in advance, but I just thought of this while we were talking, so here goes. I would submit to you, and it's okay for me to do it because obviously I follow the Oilers more closely, but I think Jerome McGinley has reached or is close to reaching a point where we can talk about him being a Hall of Fame caliber player. Would you put your goaltender near there or in the Hall of Fame, or at least in the conversation, based on what he's done as up to now?
Well, that's a tough question, especially Hall of Fame is as much subjective as it is objective when it comes to getting guys in there. The issue with Kiprusoff probably is he came to his prominence so late in his career. I mean, he was a third string goalie until he got traded to the Flames when he was, I think, 27 or 28. So it's he doesn't have a long career to look back on. I mean, if he had started at 22, he'd probably have more, more wins, more accolades behind his name. So it's really tough. I think if he keeps up what we see right now through the rest of his contract with Calgary, it's possible. But if he falls back to what we saw last year over the remainder of his time here as a Flame, probably not.
You got a chance to see the AHL team, the Heat, this week, and I know they're a little thin because of all the call-ups.
Oh.
What impressed you or didn't impress you about that group, based on, obviously, they're undermanned and they got beat, but what did you see that you liked from the Heat?
Well, it was a tough night. The Barons beat them 4-0, and they couldn't put a puck in the ocean. The Heat had a number of good looks, but two-on-ones were bobbled and pucks were shot into chests, and that's part of it is they don't really have a lot of guys in the lineup right now. I liked Brian Connolly, who's a player they just got from the Chicago Blackhawks for Morrison, although he's a defender, he's fast, he obviously has some hands, but he's really little, so it's going to be interesting to see if he can sort of battle his way up the depth chart. I saw Roman Horak, who's the 20-year-old rookie we had in Calgary for 30 or 40 games, and he was the number one center there on merit when I saw, so he looked very good. He got called up today because of the Blair Jones injury. Aside from that, not a whole lot.
I did like Horak when he played here earlier for the Flames. I thought he was a good young player, and I actually have been impressed with the number of call-ups who've done well for Calgary, actually goal, defense, and forward. With all of these injuries now, do you think the Flames are going to be active at the deadline or just do a tweak or two?
That's a very good question. I mean, I was on the Heat broadcast in between the two periods that night with Ryan Pinder, who's the play-by-play man, and he asked me the same question. I said it could go either extreme. It could be absolutely nothing, or they could make a pitch for Carter. I mean, it could be any of those two things, especially. The issue with a team like the Flames is they don't have a lot to give. That's one of the traps of being mediocre is you sort of have to try to keep all the good pieces you have, but those are the pieces you have to put into play if you want to get something else back. So it's a tough dance.
Do you think there's an appetite, and this is me going off the scale here, but you mentioned Carter. Do you think there's an appetite to trade if necessary? Your young center Backlund is a fine young player, but this isn't his year, mm-hmm. obviously, or the first round pick or a combination, or is that like, oh my God, we're doing it all over again?
I think if you asked Flames fans, they'd be pretty split on the question, just because some people are really tired of what they consider sort of a hamster wheel, where the Flames, keep going for it, keep putting out futures, and just keep running in place. Whereas other fans think, well, good player, Backlund's not producing, so why not, mm-hmm. swing for the fences. Backlund's an interesting case, actually. He's having a Hemsky year. His relative Corsi on the team is the best. He starts more often in the defensive zone, but he has a PDO of 94.4, which is absolutely probably one of the worst in terms of luck percentages in the league, I think, right now. I mean, pucks just aren't going in when he's on the ice, even though he outchances the bad guy. So, personally, that's a player I hope the Flames don't sell short right away here.
Is it a matter of Backlund not getting the right situation or being used in the with not quality wingers, or is it just he's clanging things off the post or falling down in the slot or whatever?
It doesn't seem to matter for him. He had a few games. He's had a few games in the top six with good players. He's also spent a lot of time with. I mean, recently he was playing with Kalanos and Boma, who are two AHLers. So, it for him, it just nothing seems to go in when he's on the ice for whatever reason. And like Hemsky this year, that just happens to some players. And the good stuff is the other underlying numbers, the possession numbers. Who he's playing with. He's got the second hardest quality of competition rating on the team behind Jokinen, and he's 22 years old. I mean, those are really good indicators for a kid in his sophomore year.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. Quick question here, and then we're going to ask you about hockey days and your childhood and how you came to love hockey so much. But of the Canadian teams aside from Vancouver, do you see a team aside from Calgary that you think is going to make a big push at the deadline and is an odds-on favorite to also make the playoffs?
Ooh, well, I guess Ottawa's knocking on the door, which is probably pretty surprising to everyone who thought they would be one of the last teams in the league when it started. But I don't know if I see them making any big moves. I still see that organization kind of in the middle of a rebuild. So mm-hmm. I think they'll be happy with whatever happens this season, and they'll just keep trying to stockpile futures. So. Yeah, I don't know if any of the Canadian teams are going to make a really big move at the deadline. Vancouver, I mean, what can they add, really?
No, really, yeah.
So
yeah, they're loaded.
Yeah.
Hockey Day in Canada, it's becoming a tradition. It's I feel like it's sort of like the trade deadline of the World Juniors. It's something that television made up and people are rolling with it. But it does have an appeal because we all get to reminisce, and old guys like me love to do that. What was your strongest memory of Hockey Day's past, or how did you come to it, and why do you love the game so much?
I was the first of three brothers in my household. I started hockey late, actually, just because when I was younger, I was so small that my feet didn't fit into skates until I was about eight. So when I started playing hockey, I was the worst player on my team. I hadn't skated really before, but I kind of worked my way up. And then having two brothers, they sort of caught on. Of course, the second brother, he became much better than I ever did. He went on to be an Alberta Select. I had a cousin who was a Calgary Canuck, and my dad ran a an association, hockey association here. So I've sort of been steeped in hockey my whole life. And, of course, I've been a Flames fan since I was about five.
any strong Flames memories that just stand out above all others? And then I'm going to tell you a Flames story in a minute. But
it probably involves an Oilers scoring on it. <thing. laughs>
No, it's not that.
I think my strongest Flames memory is the Stanley Cup win.
Yeah.
Doug Gilmour. Scoring the last two goals, and I think Lanny scored in the final game as well. So, I mean, that stands as still the high watermark for the organization. And I think I was only about 9 or 10 at the time, but I still remember the game very clearly.
Oh, yeah. No, it was, and that's actually part of my story. My father-in-law, big Calgary Flame fan, lived in Medicine Hat his whole life. And I used to absolutely, like, be vicious with him because I was an Oiler fan.
Yeah.
And I would pound on the fact that the Oilers would beat the Flames in those classic games. Actually, the reason the Oilers were so good is they had to beat those great Flames teams.
Yeah.
But when they finally won the Stanley Cup, I was so, like, it sounds ridiculous, but I was so happy for them that they finally made the grade because, as you remember, or maybe you don't, in 86 they got clear again and didn't win the Stanley Cup.
But yeah, I remember that too.
But in 89 they did it, and it was really an outstanding thing. And of course, Lanny was his favorite player, so it's a fond memory of mine. So I'm sure Flames fans, that's got to be number one if they were around to enjoy it.
Yeah, for sure. I think the other one for me is Darren Fleury scoring a breakaway on Grant Fuhr.
You know, you had to bring that up, didn't you? I'll tell you what, if there was any Oiler fan who could have stood at center ice, he wouldn't have stood for a long time after he did that, when he just slid down and went nuts.
No doubt. Unbelievable.
Now, I have one more thing for you. You know it's Hockey Day in Canada, and you're the late game, right?
Yes.
Okay, I just want to warn you and all Flames fans listening, Matt Sundin is being honored tonight.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So the game will start about 6:10 your time from Toronto, because they'll do an hour and 10 minutes on that.
Mm-hmm.
So you should get a good part of the second period on Hockey Night in Canada, and then all of the third of the Flames game in Calgary.
Oh, that's good.
I'm just teasing. It'll be fine. Hey, Kent, thanks, man.
No problem. Talk
all
to
right.
You.
That's Kent Wilson from Flames Nation talking a little bit about Calgary, what they plan to do. Good conversation there about Jerome Iginla and Kipper. Man, he's playing well. Unbelievable. And they're back again, you know, for a chance to get into the playoffs. And some nice Hockey Day memories, too, about those classic games between Calgary and Edmonton, which is about 25 years ago now, so I should reminisce less and talk more about the future. It's 12:47. This is Nation Radio. We talk Oilers past, present, and future. We've got some great emails that have come in today. Going to pass a couple of those along as well. And that's just around the corner. This is Nation Radio, presented by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
This is Nation Radio, where Oilers past, present, and future, plus the biggest stories every week in the National Hockey League. A few tweets to pass along to you. This from Darcy Woodguy in regard to the conversation I had with Kent Wilson about Hemsky. What about bad body language per 60 and leaving practice early, damn it. Okay. I know he's being facetious because I've talked to him a few times. And then this from Dennis King. Best thing about the Oilers' first period has been Chris Phillips' wife. So there we go. Get some good insight on Twitter today about the first period of the hockey game. 1-0 last I checked for Ottawa against the Oilers on Hockey Day in Canada. Now, earlier today on Oilers Nation, I asked people to send emails telling me their best or most memorable hockey day for them in Canada. And Matt Henderson wrote this is beautiful. I'm going to read the whole thing, so bear with me. This is a really nice piece. Hi, Low Tide. I'm a regular commenter on Oilers Nation under the handle Archaeology. I'm 28 years old, so I was too young to appreciate the Oilers in the 80s. The Oilers of the mid-90s onwards have been my Oilers. The trade deadline has been a religious holiday for me for years, and it's those days that stand out. I've taken the day off of school and work for more than a decade, but one year I could not avoid my university class. I had an hour-long presentation to deliver. I was on edge all day, nervous because of the presentation, but also because my favorite Oiler, the Oiler who had been with me from those mid-90s onwards, was without a contract, and negotiations weren't going very smoothly to that point. It was a very real possibility that he could get traded, even though he bled Oiler blue. I was at the university, but was streaming Sportsnet on the internet in my office. As it turned out, my presentation wasn't due until just before the end of the deadline. I waited and watched until the last second. He wasn't traded. I was relieved. Better than that, Sportsnet's featured reporter said that the Oilers re-signed him. I was overjoyed. I left, delivered that presentation, smiling all the way back to the office as I went online to see a recap of the day. That hockey day went from a pleasant memory to an emotional scar in the blink of an eye. Ryan Smith was traded, Eklund was wrong. He had overstated his sources and embarrassed Sportsnet. I was lied to, and worse than that, the reality sunk in that the Oilers had ripped the heart and soul of the team and largely its fan base over a couple $100,000. It really changed everything for me. It killed the hockey innocence that I had kept intact because I was too young to understand the Gretzky trade and the deconstruction of that team. That isn't my happiest hockey day memory, but it remains the most vivid. Matt Henderson. That's well written, and I'll tell you what, you know, he's not alone. I've got a lot of friends in that 20-30 age, and that that Ryan Smith trade, it really did cut very deep. Much like I would think the Gretzky trade and the Messier trade too. That's the one that killed me. I couldn't understand how you could be competitive after that. Losing Gretzky, he was such an icon at that point, and there had been talk about him going to the States. But Messier was like an absolute hockey player. You know, I mean, he was, and the leader of the team. And well, there you go. Anyway, that was very good. And we also have this one I wanted to read from Ron Kitt. 1969-70 NHL season, Chicago Blackhawks start the year brutally with 6 losses. However, by the end of the season, standings are very close, and the last weekend determines who's in the playoffs and who isn't. Saturday night, Chicago at Montreal, and fantastically, Chicago wins. Sunday night, last game of the season. To make the playoffs, Montreal has to either beat Chicago in Chicago or score 5-plus goals. Middle of the second period, it's us 5-2. That's Chicago up 5-2. Antonio is playing great. That's Tony Esposito. Montreal decides to pull their goalie for the rest of the game in order to get more goals. My dad and I are listening to the game on the radio and loving every minute of it. Tony O plays brilliantly. Chicago wins 10-2. Montreal 68-69 Stanley Cup champions don't make the playoffs in 70. Bobby Orr and the Bruins go on to win the cup. I'll tell you what, Ron, I remember it like it was yesterday. I was so happy. The Habs lost, and then my Bruins won. That was 1970, which is about 30 years before Connor was born. But that's okay. It's all good. 12:56, we're going to take a break. On the way, Cam Charron, we're going to talk a little bit about the Canucks at the deadline. They can order a nice meal at a restaurant, I think. Not a lot to do. And Jason Greger will join us to talk about the trade deadline, Hockey Day in Canada, and more. This is Nation Radio, presented by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
A couple of minutes after 1 o'clock, this is Nation Radio, joined by Jason Greger from the Jason Greger Show. Jason, how are you, buddy?
Al, you know what? I'm doing all right, but I have to say there are times in your life when you really start to question and wonder what the sanity factor is of a coaching staff. How is it possible that the 8th overall leading scorer in the NHL, the hottest player in the NHL, and then maybe your most exciting forward, Taylor Hall, play the least amount of even strength minutes of all 12 forwards in the first period? Like, how is that coaching to win?
Well, there's two possibilities, and I throw them out only because they're the only two things, Jason. Number one, they're showcasing Hemsky because he's playing 6 minutes from what I can tell here at even strength during that period and 6-18 overall. And the second thing is that they were so mad about the penalty that they said, all right, you know, you're off for the period. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I agree, but there's got to be some reason, unless there's an injury, that they like Hall.
I'm sorry, it's a coaching staff that their priorities are so about line matchups and defensive zone starts and everything else that you like. Taylor Hall took 2 penalties, so I understand he's going to have less ice time. But the reality is, Jordan Eberle and Sam Gagner, and I know they don't kill penalties, but there was only 2 penalties in that period. Right?
Yeah.
Eberle played a whopping 2:29 of even strength at a minute and a half on the power play. You mentioned Hemsky. He played 5:39 of evens. You know, showcasing guys, sure, but it, you know, unless they're trying to lose on purpose. And you know, I don't ever claim to know more than a head coach. But the simple thing is, normally you try to. We always hear, what has every coach told us? Your best players got to be your best players. Well, don't you have to play your best players? And don't tell me that even though Eberle, Hall, and Gagner maybe didn't have a great first period, I'll tell you right now, Horkoff and Belanger and Hemsky, they can have brutal periods, and they always play. So I don't buy into that he's teaching them any sort of lesson, because I don't know what the lesson is at this point.
Well, here's another one. Lander is 3:24 at evens, and Gagner 2:34. So they've got the fourth line out there for a minute longer than the...
No, I know. It's... You know, that's a great matchup. I'm sure that, you know, the Ottawa Senators are terrified when Petrel, Lander, and Eager come over the board.
I like this. You're on fire here, Jason.
Well, it's, you know, it becomes a point where you know, and I've asked all the questions. But, we're here to develop players. Really? Who are you developing? Because I'll tell you right now, how about develop the players that are going to help you win games? Unless the owners have decided, you know what, we've got to finish 29th and get Grigorenko. I don't know what the philosophy is other than that.
Well, they're really, it does defy explanation aside from injury, or they're just teaching a lesson. We'll see as the second period rolls on. Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned on Oilers Nation, I thought it was very interesting about Andy Sutton, who's been in rumors possibly being traded. Apparently, he has a taste maybe for the city of Edmonton playing for the Oilers and may want to return if that's a possibility.
Oh, yeah. Andy's told me that for about 2 months. We've talked about it. You know, he doesn't want to, at his stage of his career, there's two things. He doesn't want to uproot his family again, and he also really likes the energy of the young guys. He says it makes him feel younger coming to the rink with those young players around. And, you know, he's got a lot of experience. He's talked to Taylor Hall about how attacking certain defensemen and stuff like that. And while that doesn't show up on the score sheets, you know, that type of experience can be invaluable to young forwards. When you have a veteran guy like Andy Sutton who's seen a lot of games, who's played against a lot of different stars, not only, you know, say, hey, watch this forward, but also can talk to them about certain defenders and, you know, what makes him, what struggles for him against certain skilled players, right? Say, this is what I would do when guys attack me this way. I struggle with it, for instance. And, you know, those are things that, you can't really put a number on the value of it. You know, Andy Sutton, is he a guy that you want playing more than 50 games? Probably not, right? But, you know, having that experience around, I do think there, it's something that's necessary. And especially because if he's a number 6 or 7 on your team, then that's fine. Like, and I guess if in a pinch he has to play the odd game or two at number 5, then fine. But to me, it's something I would at least look at. And right now, I would be leaning towards Andy Sutton more than I would be towards Cam Barker.
If you, and I agree with that, but I also think that if you sign him, you've got Whitney, Smead, Gilbert, Petrie, Sutton, and I think Peckham as your top 6. Is that strong enough?
Well, yeah, see, Peckham's another guy who, you know, he's an RFA, right? He's still a young defenseman. What you probably do with him is, you know, if you can find somebody else, sure. But, you know, to me, you re-sign those guys, and then in the hopes that you have too many NHL defensemen, and, right. And if worst-case scenario comes that you think, guess what, Peckham can't make our team, well, if you were going to lose them anyway and just let them walk away as an RFA, then who cares if you lose them on waivers?
I agree, and right? I think that if you've got Potter and Petrie, trying to win the 6-7 job along with Sutton, that's fine. The only concern then is Ryan Whitney is always a concern injury-wise. Do you think they can count on him next year, or they're going to have to do something about that too?
Yeah, see, that's a big risk, right? Like, we're talking guys who are third-pairing defensemen, right? When it comes to Whitney and finding his replacement, it is hard to find a top-four defenseman. And now, in a perfect utopian society, Oscar Klefbom maybe shocks everybody and can be in your top four, maybe. I think Jeff Petrie is probably the closest one they have who can maybe move from a guy who's a third-pairing defenseman into your top four, right? He'll develop the rest of the year. He'll get all that sort of ice time, and I think that's what, they don't have a problem developing the young players, but, you know, you just don't want to develop those young stars. You don't want to play them too much, but you can play Jeff Petrie a lot. Obviously, I'm being sarcastic, but the point is, you know, Petrie's close. To find that defenseman, it's hard to do, right? I know everyone says, well, just get a top four defenseman. We all know they need a top four defenseman, but last I checked, I can't remember the last, you know, when you have not a bona fide superstar, but how often are we seeing even top four defensemen get traded?
Well, even a guy like Rundblad isn't an established guy. He's a guy who's got some chaos to him, and he was dealt for a guy who was a lottery pick. So.
Yeah, he's been dealt twice already.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's, and those are guys because they're unproven, right? You're trading for a potential commodity. And I think, you know, the owners obviously, they need Ryan Whitney to somehow figure out his ankle issue. And if it doesn't, then, you know, obviously they're in trouble there. And that's something that, you know, teams can look at that to an extent. But, you know, I never really rip on an organization too much when guys get injured because it's the one thing in a collision sport, you want to have depth. But the reality is you can't have 6 top four defensemen. No one has that, right? You want to hope that if one of your top four defensemen goes down, you have a guy that can fill in for 15 games, right? But ultimately, he'll go back to being a third-pairing defenseman. And then that's the hardest thing. You know, the Oilers, they need to develop Klefbom and all those other defensemen and Musil. They're obviously a few years away. But to me right now, the Oilers don't have enough depth yet in the organization that I still re-sign Theo Peckham because just in case you have injuries, if that's the guy you have to call up and be a number 6, You know, I would take him over some of the guys like calling up an Alex Plante or a Taylor Chorney.
Yeah, for sure. Aleš Hemský, I'm always interested in knowing the value that people place on him. I've asked a few people, and they said, hey, you know, maybe a first-round pick, 24 to 30, depending upon who wants the player. And then I was listening to Mark Spector yesterday, and I got the feeling that it's a very soft market for Hemský. Where do you see him going at the deadline, not necessarily in terms of team, but what kind of return would you guess they'll get out of him?
You know, maybe it's because of what they got from Penner. I still think Aleš Hemský, there are teams, and because, and I base this on what history has shown me from general managers in the past. They all overpay on trade deadline and on free agency.
Yeah.
They don't overpay normally at other times of the year, but they will grossly overpay then. A team thinks, man, if we get Aleš Hemský, and all teams and a lot of coaches feel, if we get that guy in our organization, we can bring him back to the Aleš Hemský of last year and previous years. That's how they think, Alan. So I still think he's a guy that can get you, a late first round pick, of course,
yep.
Because it's only going to be teams that are vying for the playoffs. And legitimately, I think a team that, you know, like the LA Kings. Now Lombardi might be shy to do it after what happened last year, but you know, I still think there might be some teams that would seriously contemplate doing it. Right? If Troy Brouwer can get you a late first round pick, I still think Aleš Hemský can.
Yeah, I agree totally with that. Terry Jones said yesterday, I think he tweeted this out, that the Oilers are going to be active at the deadline. I assume that means more than just Hemský. We've talked about Sutton possibly staying. Who else might be in play from what you're hearing or what you think?
Well, you know, a lot of people have meant, to me, you can't trade Hemský and Sam Gagner.
No.
Right? Like, we talk about depth in the organization. Where's the depth for top six forwards? And when I say depth, I mean legitimate ones. Linus Omark is a major question mark if he can ever be that guy, right? That, you know, he might be. But you know, eventually you got to get over having mites. I know when you're in a rebuild, that's kind of what you have to base it on. But to me, I wouldn't trade Sam Gagner for, unless you're trading Sam Gagner for a return that helps you today. Maybe you trade Sam Gagner to another non-playoff team who is looking towards building their team next year as well. But I don't trade Sam Gagner to a playoff team because then you're only getting prospects and picks back.
Yeah.
They're not going to trade you anybody of significance. And you know, Gagner's still one of those guys that, I know, like the recent four-game stretch, obviously, he's an anomaly. That's not who he is. He's not going to be a 3.5 point per game player in the future. Maybe he becomes a 0.8 per game player. We don't know. But I'm still a little hesitant to move him. There's a lot of guys they'd love to move, but would anybody take them is the big question, right? I think, you know, people would love to take Ladislav Šmíd. The Oilers don't want to trade him.
I think
people would want Tom Gilbert. They don't want to trade him. I think, you know, realistically, you've got Hemský, Ryan Smith, but that's more, it's up to Ryan Smith.
Right.
Right, I think, than anything else. And after that, I don't see, you know, maybe Andy Sutton, but I don't see a lot of teams clamoring the Oilers to get the players that the Oilers want to trade. I think there will be teams calling Steve Tambellini about players that they would love to get. I just don't see the Oilers wanting to move. Obviously, they're young three kids. You know, I still think that they probably don't move. The only way they move a Pajarvi, Al, is if, you know, we look at like a Wolski-Mueller-type deal where you're going to trade for another younger player who's maybe a different dimension that you think can fit in. I don't think the Oilers want to do that yet. He was their own pick. He was a top 10 pick. It's only a few years ago. It's way too early to give up on him yet. But maybe, you know, and I'd mentioned it earlier, and I don't think it's possible, but let's say Zach Kassian in Buffalo.
You're right.
Now you're bringing in a young player, same age, but just a different style of player. That I would look at. The reality is I don't see any reason why Buffalo would do it.
And I bring this up only because it's out there. A trade of Habib Bulin would have to involve some kind of significant dollars coming back for next year too, right? You're not going to get him for like a draft pick or anything like that.
I would be surprised. I would agree with you on that for sure, right?
Yeah.
And and then if you trade away Nikolai Habib Bulin, who are you going to bring in as a goaltender to replace him? I know people have told me, well, look at Jan Denis. He's an all-star in the American League. Yeah, because he's not, and no offense to Jan Denis, he's not facing NHL shooters.
No.
You know, we've seen him in the NHL, and he's not a proven NHL guy. So let's say you trade away Nikolai Habib Bulin. Who's your backup next year if you think Dubnyk's your starter? Like, I know people will throw out Corey Schneider. Do you really think that you can get him? So, you know, you got to look at free agency and do you have three or four realistic options to make that move. And, you know, someone might say, well, Gregor, it frees up cap space. The Oilers aren't in a cap crunch next season.
No.
Right? So that's not a real big issue for them. I don't care how much money they pay out. It's not coming out of my pocket. But, you know, in a few years, if they're a cap crunch team, then, yeah, you'd want to get rid of some contracts like that. But Habib Bulin doesn't put them in a situation where all of a sudden the Oilers, I think, are going to go out and spend money. Because I look at the free agent market this year, and after if Suter gets there and Zach Parise, after that, there is nobody that you're spending big money on in free agency.
Right.
And when you're a 29th place team, essentially the worst team in the league 3 years in a row, free agents aren't coming here. You could live in New York and they wouldn't be signing with you.
Nope, for sure. You wrote a couple of articles I want to get to. One was on, you know, it's not tragic, but it's too bad. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, who had to be the consensus Calder winner based on the first 35 games of this year, now he's had some injuries. You went a little bit in depth about the two injuries he's had and whether or not they're related. Tell me a little bit about how the process began for you to ask that question and what you got out of the interview that you did with the individual who knows a little bit more about it than we do.
Yeah, well, Kim Layton, you know, he's a certified athletic strength and conditioning guy. He's a therapist. He's got his bachelor in phys ed. You know, he studied all that stuff. He's worked with pro teams, and he's worked with rehabbing a lot of different players. So, you know, I had read some, you know, Nick Kiprios saying they should shut him down. David Staples wrote an article whether or not they should shut him down. And it was just, I'd like, you know, it's easy to say shut him down. But then the reality, first of all, the player, if he knows he's healthy, I think people forget that pro players are there to play sports. They're not there to be like, okay, I'm going to wait for next year. They're just not wired that way, right? Mm-hmm. Everything's the next day for them. 7 months in a lifespan, especially of an 18-year-old, seems like an eternity. So I just wanted to find out the connection to it. And I learned a lot about the shoulder, you know, the three different joints in the shoulder. You know, it's not a free-flowing joint like the elbow or the knee. So, you know, one problem in your one joint, even though it's in your shoulder, can easily not be related to the other one. And as Kim said, he said, you know what, unless I actually had seen him and treated him, I don't know 100%, but it's very likely that, you know, they could not be related, that he could have been healed, and that hit by Brown just causes a burner. And I'm not sure if you read Kim's answer when Nugent Hopkins explained how his shoulder dropped.
Right.
That, to me, coming out, and we're only taking this on what Nugent Hopkins said, right? We haven't treated him, but this is what he said himself. You know, Kim, based on his experience, when your shoulder drops, that's not a sprain. Right? It's almost like a slight separation, which is, you know, can happen and could be the different one. So I don't think anybody truly knows except the doctors. I understand why people question it and say, oh, they came back too early, probably based on the history of this team, right? Mm-hmm. And it's happened before. And so it's a fair question. I just wanted to learn a little bit more about it and find out, you know, is it automatically connected? And it definitely sounds like it's not an automatic. There's 11 different type of injuries that can happen in one shoulder, which, you know, seems amazing to me.
The other article was, or not article, but interview. You know, I always listen to Team 1260. I love driving around listening to it all day. But I have to tell you, the Bobby Holik interview for me was just a breath of fresh air because he's so open about what he was as a player. He said, I think the line was something like, if I'm your third line center, you're winning the Stanley Cup. If I'm your first line center, you're not making the playoffs. Was that as much fun for you to do as it sounded like it was or was to listen to?
Well, you know, it's refreshing. And that's why, like, I've when people get, and I don't understand it, there's a lot of people in Edmonton that feel it's Sean Horkoff's fault that he got overpaid. Many of us are probably overpaid in our own job. We don't think we are because we all think we're more valuable than we truly are in any walk of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a whole leak, I just asked him if he put more pressure on himself when he got that ridiculous contract in New York. And you know what? The Rangers didn't do their due diligence. He even said it. He goes, you know, in New Jersey, I had a specific role and I played it exceptionally well. But that's what my ability was. Right, and players know what their ability is. Sure, guys might think, okay, maybe if I got a little bit more ice time, but you ask any third liner and you put them on a lie detector, they know that even if they played first unit power play, they could never be a 40-goal scorer. They just don't have the natural hands of a Jordan Eberle, right? They just don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was nice to have Holik be honest about it and suggest that, you know, hey, for me, It was a fun experience, but it didn't work out. But no one's ever going to turn down the paycheck. And that's why, you know, if Sean Horkoff, the way I look at it, if Sean Horkoff is your third line center in Edmonton, then you've got a good team because if you have two actual, you know, first and second line centermen, right?
Yep.
That's the key.
Well, right now, I mean, all things being equal, if Gagné can play at this level with two other wingers, Nuge can play as well as he did, and you've got Horkoff and then Belanger, that's a pretty good top four center for next year if Belanger comes through and Horkoff can stay healthy.
Yeah, and the other one that's interesting for me, honestly, the one young guy that, and I know based on this year, I honestly think in a few years, Al, Anton Lander is the one guy that people are going to talk about a lot more. I mean, saying it's just, he has the elements that, and I, you know, I've learned a lot about stats. I've always liked stats. I don't buy into all of them. I think some of them can be misleading. We can all twist any stat we want to benefit our argument. But the one thing that no stat, and some guys just, you know, my only frustration with the stats guys are the close-minded ones who think emotion is never part of the game. And it's clearly one, but none of us can ever actually say what the value is on it. Anton Lander is a born leader. He hates losing. And this is a guy who only plays 10 minutes a night, so he doesn't have the big impact. Like, he's not a guy who can be on the ice in the last 5 minutes to change the outcome of the game yet. But honestly, I have not seen a young player who's literally that frustrated and mad after losses, not in a negative way, just that competitive. Andy Sutton, Tom Gilbert have told me, they all say, you watch this guy, he is going to be a dynamic guy. Maybe just that hard-nosed third-line guy that you need that can get you maybe 20 goal seasons every now and then, but tough as nails to play against. And I think he is the one. And I'm very curious to see how his progress goes. And I'm not basing it just on offense with Anton Lander, because I think obviously you need to be put in some situations to get some offense. And when you're playing all year with Petrell and Eager, and you know it's hard to do when you're only playing about 7 minutes of even strength ice time a night. But he's the one guy that eventually down the road I see him as a centerman. And you know, maybe you know, you got one more year, Belanger and Horkoff. I'll say this right now: I don't see any chance that both of them are here for the remainder of their contracts. Okay. No way.
Well, Belanger should be fairly easy to offload based on the amount of money, and Horkoff's, I mean, it's almost unmovable until the trade deadline was last year, I would think.
Or, Al, what happens in the new CBA?
Yeah.
What if they have an amnesty rule that the NBA has? I'm just throwing it out there. This new CBA could change a lot of things. From, you know, I've been talking to different people, and you know, there a lot of them are looking at that amnesty rule in the NBA. Right, it's almost like a free pass to get rid of that one contract. And you know, it's not Horkoff's fault, but the reality is, based on your team and how much money he's making, it's not good. If Sean Horkoff was making even $3.5 million, you'd be fine with it.
Yeah.
Right, and so I'll be. That is something to me. If it gets into the new CBA, it'll be curious. And now I know as we speak, it's been interesting. We talked about I don't know, maybe they read the stat sheet of the first period and realized that the first line hasn't played very much, because it seems like they've been out every second shift here in the second period, and they've had a few good chances. Anderson's absolutely stoned Everly a few times.
Yeah, I saw that one play, made a nice glove play. Hey, this is I remember my stag. It was back when we had court sealers. And you know, you didn't really have any organized kind of situation, but your stag is tonight, is that correct?
Well, yeah, I guess, well, unofficially, I guess it starts at 3:00 with an outdoor shinny game.
Oh, hey, you're going out to where are you doing?
We're
that?
Playing at Sakers Acres.
Okay.
My buddy Brent, they had the world's longest game, and so the guys who've organized it, that's kind of the starting point. And after that, I kind of have some ideas of what's happening, but it'll be fun. Nothing, unfortunately, for all. I do find it interesting how many people think you have to have hookers and blow at your stag to be fun, but that I can say will not be a part of mine. It's not something I've ever. You know, I think it can do a lot of stupid things. Just I prefer them to be legal. That's
all. You don't want to do anything that you're not going to know about, but might be on the paper on Monday morning.
Exactly.
Hey, Jason, thanks, man.
Thanks. Have a good one.
All right, bud. That's Jason Greger from the Jason Greger Show, 123, and interesting conversation there. I loved his passion at the beginning of the conversation about that the Taylor Hall Gagné Eberle line not playing a lot, and as he mentioned, they're playing a lot more. The game seems to be coming to the Oilers a little bit better. In the second period of the game, and that was an interesting trip through the trade deadline conversation and a few things as well. So we appreciate Jason's time, and you know what, he's got some great insight, and you know, he's on every Monday through Friday right here on Team 1260. Now we've added somebody. Connor, who did we add, just so I'm clear on this?
JP Nakoda.
You know, we don't pay you enough. You're right there with that. You're so good, and he'll be coming up at what, about quarter two or so?
Yeah, as 12 40 or 140, your call.
Well, you know,
I just got him.
I'm in control of everything, as you
the
can
rest
tell.
Is on you.
On the way, it's Cam Charron from Canucks Army. This is Nation Radio, presented by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 1:29. We're here until 2 o'clock today, and then Jungle Jim Hunter joins us between 2 and 4 o'clock. 1-0 still between Ottawa and the Oilers. Much better period for the Oilers. Ottawa has a 1-0 lead, about 12 minutes left in the period, and it's still on the Alfredson goal. Elsewhere, 3-1 Florida. Man, they've had a good year, eh? Sean Bergenheim, Versteeg, and Samuelson scoring, and the goal for New Jersey from Steve Bernier. Thank goodness Henrik didn't score. He's hot, and he's getting ahead of the Nuge here. Los Angeles and the Islanders, about 5 minutes left in the third, last reported. It's 1-1 between those two teams. Rangers and Philly, oh my God. Philadelphia and goaltending, I swear to you. Honest to God, Bernie Perrant could go back there as a 25-year-old, and he wouldn't succeed. They're born under a bad sign. It's 5-2 Rangers over Philadelphia right now. Callahan with a hat trick, also goals from Gabrick has a goal in that game as well. And Nashville-Boston, a 3-3 tie. Lucic scoring to tie it up. Pittsburgh over Winnipeg, 4-2. And, of course, the Oilers score we mentioned. Cam Charron joins us now. How are you, buddy?
Alan, how's it going?
Good. What's the weather like where you are?
It is about maybe 5, 6 degrees. Partly cloudy. We're going to go out and play some road hockey to celebrate Hockey Day in Canada in a bit.
Okay.
We can get everyone together.
What's your favorite Hockey Day memory, not just Hockey Day in Canada, but your favorite hockey memory of all time?
Well, probably, I was thinking about this yesterday, probably the 2002 Winter Olympics. That was about the time that all the people that I kind of hung out with in school really started to pay attention to hockey. That was really the first time that, you know, I was starting to be able to talk about the sport with people who I never thought watched at all. And everyone watched that gold medal game against the U.S. I kind of remember everyone's reaction in the room when Joe Sakic scored the clincher.
That's awesome.
The 5-2 game. So, yeah, and of course that synced up with a really good Canucks second half run that everyone paid attention to in Vancouver. So it was a pretty good time.
No, it was great. It's funny about Canadians, right? Where people go, where were you when, or whatever. It's in Canada, it's where were you when Bob Cole said, Joe Sakic, because that was a huge goal for Canada. It was awesome.
Exactly.
The Canucks fans that I know spent a day or two in the fetal position this week after Henry went down. How did you take that?
I'm only just recovering from the fetal position, actually. Henrik Sedin is a truly marvelous player, and he's really sheltered, you know, zone start wise. So a lot of stats guys outside of Vancouver don't really see his production, but he also scores at an extremely impressive rate. And I've seen some research that he can set players up for better shots than a lot of other players in the league, and you can tell that by watching him too. He's a really important player for the team. Clearly, he's the playmaker. He drives the bus really for the Canucks offensively. And without him, I have no idea who takes over that first line center role. I'm not even sure I trust Ryan Kessler right there right now. Sedin he's always been around. He's always been an Iron Man. He's always been really consistently good for years and years and years. And I'd hate to see, especially, you know, from a puck to the leg there. It looked like that was a broken leg, 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah. Well, you know what I find interesting about the Sedins is that they were a certain level of good for so long, and then they just morphed into something else. And I think at some level, and hear me out on this, I think at some level, people missed it. They didn't realize that the Sedins went supernova. And so when you talk about them, they still think about the, you know, 03, 04 Sedins, and they don't realize that these guys are, you know, winning scoring championships. They stir the drink. They're impossible to play against. Anybody who's seen an Oiler game the Canucks are in over the last 5 years knows that they're just, I mean, you might as well go get a beer and something to eat, you know, because they're going to have the puck for 3 minutes and put it in the net. So it's crazy.
Yeah, I think against the Oilers, haven't they had, you know, 5 or 6 of their 2-minute, 30-second long shifts where they're cycling, create about 4 or 5 chances, and they usually end up with a puck in the back of the net. If you're not protecting the rebounds, covering the puck against them, you're not going to knock the puck away from them. They take a lot of flack for being soft, but they'll take cross checks right into the boards and they'll hold on to the puck all the while. It's really impressive what those two have been able to do. And I really don't think that Vancouver appreciates them as much as they will in 10, 15 years when they retire. Because I mentioned it yesterday in a post I made. These two are probably, the first ever career Canuck Hall of Famers. It seems pretty premature to say this, but I think Henrik Sedin is going to hit the 1,000-point mark. And, you know, we all know that the entry requirements for the Hockey Hall of Fame are generally pretty lax. And I think that with what those two are going to accomplish, what they've accomplished in the last 3 years and what they'll probably accomplish in the next three, that'll probably give them a ticket to entry.
From time to time, we talk about advanced stats on this show, and there's an interesting thing happening in Vancouver, and it does involve one of the Sedins. It's zone start at center ice. Manny Malhotra starts near the Zamboni every shift, and then Kessler and Sedin get a little bit of a push, especially Sedin. Obviously, he covers it in terms of the offense, but how long has that been going on, and is it getting more drastic? Because it looks like it is.
Oh, it's getting incredibly drastic at this point. I think that Manny Malhotra has taken one faceoff in the offensive zone since 2012 started. I think that that's the number we're at, and I don't even remember it happening. It's been going on for about 2 years, maybe, that the Sedins have really seen a lot of offensive zone time, but it really picked up last year when the Canucks got Malhotra, and Alain Vigneault really knows that he can trust Manny Malhotra to win those draws. He's one of the best faceoff guys in the league. He's good at, and they have some depth of defensemen who do nothing but chip the puck out. And it's this role that a lot of Canucks fans probably don't also appreciate, but just moving the puck forward from that defensive zone and let Kessler and the Sedins do their work. It's something that a few other teams are catching on to doing. Chicago does it to an extent with Dave Boland and Jonathan Toews. And even in Edmonton at the start of the year, I think I read some things that even at home, Sean Horkoff was protecting Ryan Nugent-Hopkins the same way, but that kind of tailed off as the year went on, I believe.
Do you feel like, I think it was you I was talking to about Roberto Luongo, and if it was, we both agreed he'd get back toward the median, which he's done. Do you think Canuck fans are on side with him again, or is he always going to be the guy who didn't win the cup unless he wins the cup?
I think that if he doesn't win the cup, he will always be the guy who didn't win the cup. That's not a way that, Kirk McLean is treated here, because he was an absolute hero during the Canucks 94 playoff run. Same thing with Richard Brodeur in 82. And I think just because the Canucks were a much better team than the 94 or 82 teams, that Luongo took a bit more heat than maybe he deserved. Keep in mind, he got two shutouts in the Stanley Cup Finals, which not many goalies are able to do, but he also put up three really brutal starts. He's for the last couple weeks or so, I think that Canucks fans have kind of ignored some of the turbulations he's been through in the last while. I think I just made up a word with turbulations, which I'm completely fine with.
It's a good word.
It's a tremendous word there. I'm going to write that down. He's really playing as he was in 2007, when he was really the only guy on the team except for the Sedins and Marcus Naslund who were scoring. You can count on him every night to put up a quality start, to keep that goal count under two goals. And he may not get the shutouts that a lot of people expect elite goalies to get, but he gives the Canucks a chance to win every night the way that he's been playing. And the Canucks themselves have not been really good for the past 20 games or so. So Luongo's really been keeping them in games, and they've been winning a ton of close games recently.
What do you see them? I look at the Canucks, and I've said this since Christmas time. I really can't say, unless they have an injury that we don't know about or it's on the way, we can always hope. they don't really have any huge need. Is there some area that you'd like to see the Canucks address at the deadline?
I think in the weeks leading up to the deadline, I'm usually down on not taking the risk. We went for a guy. Well, not me. I wasn't part of the management team, but they went after Martin Rushinsky the day after Todd Bertuzzi got suspended, which was the trade deadline. And he never really panned out in Vancouver, of course, because of the deadline pickup. And I just see so many instances where the deadline deals don't work out. Now, Chris Higgins was one who did because the Canucks were able to re-sign him to a couple extra years. But since he's been injured, I don't really think that the Canucks have a really fourth viable top six winger, which sounds crazy that, you know, you only have three of four top six wingers. Not many teams have two. But yeah, I think that they could use a little bit of added punch there. Probably I wouldn't want to see them overpay for them though. But the guy that I really like, who I don't hear a lot of talk about, is Andre Kostitsyn out of Montreal. Mm-hmm. And when his brother Sergei left Montreal, he's been scoring up a storm in Nashville. Of course, he's been aided by some favorable percentages, but I think that Andre, he hasn't been playing very much power play time, I've noticed. And he still has 12 goals on the season. I don't think that he's a guy that people are talking enough about as being a potential winger for a team looking to bulk up at the deadline. I don't know what Montreal's plans are with him. He's a player that you aren't hearing very much about in the national media.
We'll give you Hemsky, but you have to send Edler. Is that a fair deal?
Okay. Well, I'll warn you that Alex Edler, he doesn't really play all that well when he has to play more than 24 minutes a night. So
we have that problem.
The guy that you're looking for to be your number one defenseman.
Wait a minute. We already have defensemen who can't play 24 minutes a night here. We don't need him.
Yeah. You do have six of those. So. Alex Hemsky, I'm really interested to see what the Oilers actually end up doing with him. I've been reading a lot of Tyler Dallas' takes on him, and he's just gone completely, taken this big beef with Edmonton management, which is really fun to see. And I really do think that the Oilers should find a way to re-sign Hemsky because he's still young enough to help this team contribute 5, 6, 7 years down the road. Giving him up, I just don't see that the Oilers would be able to get the assets back that that they'd give up with him. I just don't see the return coming because you might get two picks and spend them on defensemen. Maybe one pans out 6 or 7 years down the line, which is when you want Hemsky to be producing for you. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do with him. But if I'm an Oilers fan, I really hope that that Steve Tambellini does re-sign Alex Hemsky.
Oh, absolutely. And Tyler does make some great points. I think he had two Hemsky posts up, and both of them really talked about, you know, the value of the player. And you know, you're not only wasting time getting that pick or whatever you get back in terms. These guys just don't grow on trees. And I know he's having a bad year, but it's not like he's 35 and having a bad year, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and the other Tyler post that I really liked this week was about Jordan Eberle scoring a really high percentage of points on Oilers goals, and that's probably not going to last. That's something that I've been kind of thinking of, but I never actually done the research on. And so, like you said, good for Jordan Eberle, bad for the Edmonton Oilers. And
yeah, well, especially because he's going to be probably signed this summer, and he may end up having. I'm not suggesting it's going to be an albatross contract, but an overpay is not just possible but likely, right?
Yeah, I think that he'll be someone that's probably going to get a bit of an overpay, but still, he's a young player. He's still improving, and he's just fantastic to watch. And the killer of Russians, Jordan Eberle, that everybody loves. It's always good to have him around because, what's the alternative? You're not going to get rid of Jordan Eberle. He's the best player on the team right now, as far as I'm concerned.
No, he's a great player. By the way, Pajarvi scored, so all is white in the Oilers' world.
Pajarvi just scored?
Yeah, he just scored. Now we're going to make him captain and give him $6 million a year. So it's all coming together. You guys will be so sorry.
Well, just watch him put up an 8-point night right now, and everything will be forgiven.
That's what you have to do. The only thing you have to do if you're an Oiler is put up an 8-point night, then you can. Then we love you again.
As long as you keep it up with 2 and 3-point nights for the rest of the week, and I'm not sure what's going to happen when he cools off, but.
Well, he has to cool off.
I definitely never thought that I'd hear this much about Sam Gagner later in the year.
No, it's great. It really is. I find him interesting because his 5x5 point for 60 has been low all year, but climbing, and now it's above where it was. But last year it was 191. I think it's 228. So I think he was waiting on some bad luck, and it finally came through for him.
Oh, yeah. And if any of the listeners here are tracking PDO at all, the addition of on-ice save percentage and on-ice shooting percentage, his was well below the mean before the 8-point night, and it was above 100 the day after.
Yeah.
Which was always something fun to look at.
You know what, Cam? I enjoy this. We got to have you back. You're an interesting guy.
All right. Thanks for having me on, Alan.
All right. Thanks so much. Cam Charon from Canucks Army. Good guy and very insightful. You can check him, not just at Canucks Army, but get him on Twitter, and then you can find out all where he posts, because he's a busy guy. Speaking of which, this is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors, and we have added a guest, because Connor is so cool and active, and he knows what he's doing. JP Nakota from Pension Plan Puppets on the way. We'll take a break and be back right after this.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Turning with it in his own zone. Unable to get to his McCollum. Hemsky sends it in front of his back. Scores! Piarvi looks to the roof as he breaks his slump of 36 games and ties this game at one apiece.
Wow. And another goal was just scored. Ottawa scored, and Hemsky made a McFly play, and then Eager just scored for the Oilers, so it's tied 2-2 now, and so we're pretty excited here. Now we're going to JP Nakota from Pension Plan Puppets and various parts on the internet. JP, how are you, man?
Doing well. How about you, Al?
Good. Sundin ceremony tonight. That's got to be pretty cool.
Really looking forward to it. I mean, fans were sort of slow to warm up to Sundin, but by the time he scored his 500th goal there against the Flames, I think everyone was just really on board. I mean, he's just a classy guy all around. Was with the organization forever, and I mean, really, what can you say? Yeah, it's going to be a great night. Going up against the Habs, hockey night in Canada, can't get a better stage.
Here's what I don't understand, and I'm not picking on the Leaf fans. We all knew Sundin was an absolute killer for like years and years and years and years, and I understand that they were slow to pick up. What more could Sundin have done during his time with Toronto to appease the fans? The guy killed every night.
Well, you know what? I think it was really more about the environment he came into, right? The Leafs just weren't that far removed from their big run in 93 with Gilmore and Clark. And then, of course, they traded Clark for Sundin. So, you know, I think that left a few fans sort of disgruntled that these, you know, small-town Canadian boys that led their team to a pretty good playoff run for the first time in a long time, you know, they're a bit disgruntled that he was being replaced with, or Clark, that is, was being replaced with somebody that, you know, they didn't really know that much about. And,
okay,
you know,
that makes sense.
He is from Sweden, and that's a bit strange. And, it just took people a while to get used to the idea that he really was a great leader for the team.
Well, he was a pleasure to watch forever and ever, and he really did play well deep into his 30s. There's no doubt about that. And I'm sure Toronto always does a splendid job saying goodbye to these guys, so I know it'll be well done tonight. Leafs are in a battle for the playoffs. I think they're looking pretty good. I've said this on occasion, and Leaf fans are quick to tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about, but the odds favor the Leafs in terms of games played and where they are for them actually to get into the playoffs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of indicators that look good. Goal differential is one, suggests that they'll be one of the top eight come the end of the season. The fact that the Ottawa Senators, I think, are not finished slipping also bodes well, because I think Washington is coming on strong, and if someone's got to get the squeeze, my guess is the Sens.
What about the trade deadline? I look at the Leafs, and I watch them quite often, because in Western Canada, you don't have a choice. They're on hockey night in Canada between 5 and 8 every Saturday, so you don't have a choice. But I watch them quite often, and they look to me to be really skilled. They're maybe not as strong down the middle as you'd like them to be, although Grabowski is ridiculous. Where do they need to add at the deadline, in your opinion?
Well, you know, I mean, the truth is, they get out at a few positions. I mean, there are still a lot of questions in goaltending, though I think Burke and Wilson are sort of happy to see what comes of James Reimer and Jonas Gustafsson for the moment, so I don't think they're going to touch that. The defense is, you know, probably their area of strength. So if any significant roster player is coming out, expect it to come from the back end. Luke Shen's name has been bandied about quite a bit in connection with James Van Riemsdyk. That's been, you know, talked about a fair bit these days. There are a number of other young defenders, however, that are garnering interest around the league. Corbinian Holzer, he's on the cusp of making the NHL. It's more for the fact that the Leafs already had seven or eight NHL-caliber defenders, he'd probably already be playing. But also Cody Franson, big body, big shot from the point, good on the second unit. He's been garnering some interest as well. Up front, Burke has said he really wants to add some size. And, you know, that's one of the things that I would say I think it might actually help the Leafs. They're not great when it comes to puck recovery. Lots of speed, not a lot of big bodies, not a lot of, you know, fight along the board kind of players.
JP, I got you on late, and I got to say goodbye, but I'm going to have you on again soon. And thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Alan.
All right, JP Nakoda from Pension Plan Puppets. We thank him for his time, and you can hear his voice. You know what? The goodbye to Matt Sundin is going to be great tonight. And what an outstanding hockey player. Man, he was good in a Toronto Maple Leafs uniform. My thanks to Jason Greger, Cam Charon, Kent Wilson, Jonathan Willis, JP Nakoda, and, of course, Connor Behind the Glass, who does all the magic that you hear here every Saturday afternoon. This is Nation Radio. See you next Saturday.